Chapter 20. The next morning, Jamie is in my driveway stretching his legs in the dawn twilight. I nod hello before whispering my prayer at the tree. I omit putting down any sema because of my moon time. When I begin my warm-up routine, Jamie aligns his stretches with mine. It is as if no time has passed since our last run, before Lily flew away, and I became a secret squirrel. Last night, Levi called you Firekeeper's daughter. What was that about? He asks. I put one foot forward to stretch my quadriceps and hamstrings in a lunge position. Well, there's a teaching about the daughter of the original Firekeeper, I say. She starts each day by lifting the sun into the sky and singing. We do lunges on the other leg. He looks expectantly at me, waiting for more info. My brother calls me that sometimes, our dad's last name and all. He thinks it's ironic because I'm a really bad singer. I roll my eyes and continue stretching as the sky lightens. I don't like her story, because she doesn't even get her own name in it. Her identity is in a relation to her dad, Firekeeper, and then her husband, First Man, called Anishinaabe, and then her sons, named after each of the four directions. She gets stuck with the responsibility of lifting the sun every morning. I do a few jumping jacks. What if she was tired one day and said, "Screw it, I'm going back to sleep." I motion toward the street and begin jogging. Just seems like a raw deal. All that responsibility and you don't even get your own name. Jamie follows my gentle pace for the few blocks to my brother's place. The houses get bigger the closer we get. I think about the extra name I add to my morning prayer so Creator will know who I am. What if Creator knows exactly who I am? I've been the one tying my identity to my father. Telling Jamie her story brings out the contradiction in my prayers each time I introduce myself. Ishkude Ganewedun Odanisen, Firekeeper's daughter. I decide that from now on, I'll leave out that extra name. My spirit name is enough. I should ask Auntie the word in Anishinaabe Moin for the beams of light you can see when the sun hides behind clouds. In science, they're called crepuscular rays. I think the word is Zagaso? If I'm right, that's what I'll call Firekeeper's daughter from now on. Her own identity, Zagasique. I make out the shapes of two guys stretching in a driveway. Levi lives in a studio apartment over the garage at his mom's, I say. Stormy too, most of the time. Jamie raises an eyebrow. Well, Stormy's family is kinda messed up. Stormy used to hitch a ride from Sugar Island whenever his parents fought. He tossed pebbles at Levi's window until my brother woke up and let him in. It happened so often that Dana put a key under the garden gnome statue by the back door for him. Anything she did for Levi, she did for Stormy. Going shopping for school clothes or hockey gear, she'd buy Stormy his own stuff, not hand-me-downs either. It's what I like most about Dana Firekeeper. She grew up poor and made sure Stormy didn't feel the way she did. Levi told me that when his mom was a little girl, she shared a bed with her sisters and they'd wake up to snow dusting their blanket from a hole in the roof. Levi and Stormy fall in beside us. Hey, Bubble, wanna take a detour past the mansion? Stormy attempts to rattle me. I glare at him, but he keeps talking. Weren't you at the party at the big house, Jamie? What did you think of it? Us per cap nishnobs are new money. Bubble is old money. Trust fund money. He does a half laugh, half snort. You could have bought a car anytime you wanted. Geez, Stormy, did someone piss in your oatmeal today? I say. Levi sticks up for me. It's all cool, Storm. She wants to earn it and not coast by. He smiles my way. I respect that. I have complicated thoughts about my trust fund. Grand Mary explained it was for my education, a car, and a good start in life. She said it was a safety net so I'd never be trapped in an unfortunate situation. I'm conflicted about using it because I was my mother's unfortunate situation. What choices would she have made if she'd had access to a trust fund? Like me, Stormy's weird about Junya. I can see why. Before Levi turned 18, Dana deposited his minor money, a monthly check one-third the amount of an adult member's per cap check, into a joint account for him to access. Stormy's mom doesn't do that. Shauna Noden is Ojibwe, but from a band in Wisconsin. One time she rented the Ogima Suite at the Superior Shores and threw a huge party that lasted the weekend. The Monday after, she filled out an application at Tribal Social Services for the Emergency Needs Program to pay her shutoff notices. Ever since, they call her Shauna Shutoff. As we approach the Edwards' house of steel and glass, Mike appears from nowhere, like a ninja. He immediately matches his stride with the group's. The guys blather, but I cannot manage any words. Their pace is halfway between my normal speed and a full sprint. Mike farts loudly and everyone cracks up. "Damn, boog it. That one sounded wet," Stormy says. Levi tells Jamie, "Boog it is Mike's honorary Indian name. It means fart, but we should have named it Moen because I think he just crapped himself." "How do you know it wasn't Bubble?" Stormy asks. "'Cause Grand Mary would disinherit her if she ever cut one like that." More laughter. The downside of hanging out with the guys is that they're super gross. If I had a dollar for every fart that I've endured around them, I wouldn't need a trust fund. I tune them out, focusing instead on the sound of my breathing. The route takes us along the river to where it curves past the ferry launch and the country club. I catch a fragment of the story Levi is telling Jamie about me. "So I'm walking on top of a climbing thing like a little badass. A few drops of rain make it slippery, and the next thing I know, I'm flat on my back looking up at it. That's when Donis comes running over, yelling not to move me." We cut through the southern edge of the golf course to reach a trail that will lead us to the powwow grounds. Levi keeps blabbing. "My sister gets on all fours to keep the rain off my head. She orders the playground monitor to call an ambulance." Levi looks my way. "And we were, what, 11? 9. It was right after the Superman actor fell off his horse and became paralyzed." I say, able to manage words only because we slowed down on the trail. I don't mention how scared I was that day. I nearly peed my pants at the thought of my brother being seriously injured. Up to that day, Dana had treated me politely, though not warmly. I even thought she deliberately held Levi back a year so we wouldn't be in the same grade together. But when Auntie and I arrived at the hospital to check on Levi, Dana hugged me for the first time. Between sobs, she repeated "miigwech" into my ear for what seemed like an hour. Our relationship changed, bonded by our love for Levi. I look at my brother's back as we run single file. For all the times he annoys me, there are many more times when I'm profoundly thankful for him. "Ball out," Levi shouts over his shoulder to the rest of us. The guys break into a sprint for the final quarter mile across the powwow grounds and along Ice Circle Drive to Chemukwa. I should have known that this was just a warm-up for them, and now their real workout will come from lifting weights at the fitness center. By the time I catch up, they're well into their post-run stretches. I collapse onto soft, cool grass, face down and arms splayed. I want to lick the moisture from each blade. Once the guys finish their cool down, they shout their goodbyes. Jamie follows behind Levi, but at the last minute, he says something to my brother and runs over to me. I roll over and flop onto my back. Jamie eases into push-up position, rising into a plank so his face is slightly above my raised head. Jamie plants a quick kiss on my cheek. "Is Levi watching?" he whispers. I glance over to where my brother stands, grinning at us from an entrance. "Yep." I walk slowly and stiffly to Evercare. The scent of roses fills the hallway outside Grand Mary's room. Pausing in the doorway, I watch Mom massaging lotion on her mother's toothpick legs. She exhausts herself looking after Grand Mary, who wasn't always kind to her. What if it's a strength to love and care for someone you don't always like? Mom was adamant that Uncle David hadn't relapsed. I know now that he didn't, but even if he had, she would have continued to love and support him. What if my mother is actually a strong person disguised as someone fragile? I walk over to Mom instead of plopping down on Grand Mary's bed like I usually do. Bending down, I kiss my mother's cheek. I inhale a whiff of lilac perfume at her neck, gentle as a whisper in a room where the roses shout over one another. I kiss her again, just because. It's my first day at Lake State, I tell Grand Mary after a blink brings her back to us. She breaks into a huge smile. I have class at 9, so I can't stay long. I love you. After a quick shower and yogurt for breakfast, I race in the Jeep to the parking lot behind the student union. I run across the quad, past Fontaine Hall, to arrive at class, breathless and anxious. The only seats left are in the front row. I sit and glance at the empty one next to me. You should be here, Lily. The professor reviews the syllabus for Principles of Macroeconomics. Every other sentence is an admonition. This is not high school. I don't take attendance. I don't check on missed assignments or reschedule exams. I don't speak with parents. You, and only you, are responsible for your academic performance. If this is not what you signed up for, leave now or forever hold your peace. I don't want to be here without my best friend. I get up and leave. Now what, Lily? Pinpricks stab my nose and a fist-sized lump swells in my throat. I struggle to take deep, gulping breaths. Water. Maybe water will help. I dig in my backpack but come up empty. As I reach for the door of the student union, TJ Kiwaden exits. Surprise flickers across his face before it's replaced with a smooth, impersonal mask. He walks past, dressed in a plain white t-shirt, jeans, and rugged work boots. He smells clean and woodsy. That asshole is still wearing the cologne I bought for him. I grab the first item in my backpack. Macroeconomics, Understanding the Wealth of Nations, lands with a thud 2 feet from TJ. He spins around, something angry flashing across his face before the mask returns. I don't know which is more infuriating, that he's pissed off or that he covers it up like a big faker. Just then, Robin Bailey walks past TJ. She picks up my textbook. One hand passes me the book, and the other hand firmly pulls me inside the student union. Girl, you gotta get over TJ, she says while handing me a bottle of water from her backpack. No guy should have that kind of power over you, no matter who he is or how much everyone adores him or how much you might still want him. I do not want TJ, I say bristling. She gives me a look verging on pity. Robin graduated 2 years ago, with TJ, class of 2002. Her sophomore year, she was the first girl in the Sioux ever to make the boys' varsity hockey team. I joined her the following year as a freshman. We were teammates for the 2 years we overlapped at Sioux High. She played 1 year at Cornell before transferring to Lake State last year. It's just, he just happened to catch me in a low moment, I say. Yeah, I know how that goes, she says in sympathy. You don't have to be a superhero, Donnie. It's okay to not be okay. I'm kind of surprised you're even here. I thought it was what Lily would want me to do. I wipe away a tear. Robin is content to sit with me in the cafe and let me be sad. How about if you pick 2 classes and drop the others? What class was Lily looking forward to the most? She hands me napkins for my runny nose. I smile. American literature of the 20th century. And what class were you most excited about? Plant morphology. Of course. She shakes her head in amusement. When's your next class? 10, American Lit. Give it a try. No pressure. See how it goes. You like it, you stay. Same with the plant class. She takes my phone and calls herself before handing it back to me. Call if you want me to go with you on Friday to the registrar's office to drop anything you aren't excited about. Miigwech, I say. She stands to my left and raises her right arm in front of me. I grin and do the same with my left arm to make an X with hers. We used to do this with our hockey sticks when we skated onto the ice before every game. It was her idea. For all the little girls like us who chose hockey skates over figure skates. I walk to my next class, American Literature, and sit in the back row closest to the door. Scanning the reading assignments on the syllabus, I look for one in particular. Uh-oh, no Mishner. Granny June's harangue on the literary underestimation of James A. Mishner lasts from the time I pick her up for lunch until I bring her home that afternoon. The following day, as I help her into the Jeep, Granny picks up where she left off. You better tell that Zaganosh smarty pants that James A. Mishner is the greatest American novelist of my lifetime, she yells. The professor is black, I say. And yes, I will for sure tell her about your opinion. Not opinion, fact. After I brought Granny June her tray of Indian taco with whole wheat fry bread, I stand in line for myself. John Z. Kiwaden knocks over the coffee mug he's just filled. I grab napkins to clean up the mess. When I hand him a fresh mug, he motions toward the sugar. But what about your diabetes? I say. I'm not a diabetic, he shouts. I'm a Presbyterian. I laugh. John C.'s a twice-a-week Catholic. Hey, his tone changes to a conspiratorial whisper. I took TJ back to the landfill after the storm, and that bag was gone. You didn't take it, did you? Hauling toxic garbage doesn't sound like something a rational person would do, Grandpa John C., I say, leading him back to his table of friends. John C.'s brother, Jimmer, gets my attention. Hey, firekeeper, my grandson got me an iTunes card. What the hell am I supposed to do with that? You can buy any song online for 99 cents and burn a CD, I explain. Like making a tiny album of your favorite songs. Jimmy Rogers and Ernest Tubb? As long as their stuff is in the iTunes catalog, I say. I'll grab my laptop after lunch. We can use your gift card today, and I'll bring your CD tomorrow. I tell Granny that after lunch I'm helping Jimmer Kiwaden buy songs online. That old gangster, she says. The Elder Center director makes announcements before they do the 50-50 raffle. Tribal Youth Council will be there Thursday afternoon to help anyone set up their cell phones. You can get emergency alerts or send a group text to your friends with fairy updates. Holy wah, John C. says loudly. Modern day moccasin telegraph. Oh, and a young woman's missing. Tribal citizen, Heather Noden, was last seen walking through Paradise on Monday night. Anyone with info should contact tribal police. Heather is missing? I don't remember seeing her around the bonfire when Macy told the story about Creator's gifts. Maybe she left right after offering me drugs and telling off Macy. I make a note to let Jamie know that I might have been one of the last people to interact with Heather Noden. By Friday, I've dropped down to two courses and have become an iTunes mix master. Granny and I spend most of the afternoon on the island. She and Minnie rehash old arguments. I cannot imagine sparring for decades like that with Macy. What I have decided, as a secret squirrel, is that while I'm helping an elder buy songs from iTunes, I can ask about medicines and stuff. Good trade, as John Z would say with a wave of his hand, mimicking a scene out of Dances with Wolves. Jimmer Kiwaden tells me that Al Capone did indeed hide whiskey in a cave along Lake George, the east side of Sugar Island. Do people explore the caves looking for anything he left behind? Every now and then a dead body washes up. That scares away most with good sense. Leonard Manitou, Minnie's son, Chief Manitou's dad, and Macy's grandpa, reveals that when he was 5 years old, he went missing for 2 days, and nobody except his mom and grandma believed the little people had kept him safe. Bucky Noden, who everyone calls Buck Naked, catches my attention. He is Heather's great uncle, I think, and might want to know when I last saw Heather. Instead, he seems scattered and asks how much it would cost to get every song Patsy Cline ever recorded. Before I can answer, Buck mentions the time he accidentally snared his own cat instead of a rabbit. Then he tells me he used to go picking mushrooms with his great-grandma on Duck Island. Mushrooms? On Duck Island? I say before he can jump to another random topic. My heart beats so fast, I'm sure Buck can see it through my Red Wings t-shirt. When Ron brought me to Uncle David's classroom, he named three locations where hallucinogenic mushrooms had been found: Tequemanon Falls, Pictured Rocks, and Sugar Island. On the drive back from Marquette, Ron provided an important detail about the location where Uncle David had been: Duck Lake on Sugar Island. Duck Island is bordered on one side by Duck Lake.
"Yeah," Buck says. "That little island within an island is full of them. Something about the soil and moisture. All them old trees ain't never been chopped down."
I look around, flush with excitement over picking up Uncle David's mushroom research. Sini Nimki scowls across the dining room as if she knows what I'm thinking. "This secret squirrel is in search of a nut. A hallucinogenic mushroom of a nut."